The History of the Labour Movement by Ted Tripp and Chris Gaffney. Chapter 1. The Birth of Capitalism. The birth of capitalism is the process of the penetration of capital into the sphere of production, whereas under feudalism, surplus was basically the simple profit made from the buying and selling of goods. Here the merchant was limited in scope, as most people had access to the means of production to satisfy the bulk of their needs. Most people lived then on the land and were largely self-sufficient. What are the origins of the capitalist system? The triumph of capitalism required, 1. That the producers be separated from the means by which their material needs are produced. That is, that the peasant, the guildman, the small producer, should not be able to satisfy their needs through possession of the means of production. 2. That these means of production become the monopoly of one class, the rising bourgeoisie. 3. Finally, it is the appearance of another social class, separated from the means of production without any other way of earning a living than by the sale of its labour power to the sole possessors of the means of production. This new class, the incipient working class, said to become free with the decline of feudalism, became free in two senses. A. Freed and not like slaves, who are in fact part of the means of production and require maintenance as such. Secondly, free in that they are separated from the means of production and therefore able to sell their labour power to the capitalist, that is, become wage labourers with no control of the enterprise. The process that clears the way for capitalism can be none other than the process which takes away from the labourer the possession of the means of production, a process that transforms the social means of subsistence and of production into capital, which can then exploit others' labour, and so realise a surplus, and secondly, turning the people who produce themselves into wage labourers. Capitalism grew out of the economic structure of feudal society. The dissolution of feudalism set free the elements that became capitalism. The accumulation of capital. Capitalism dates from the 16th century. The money capital formed by means of usury, borrowing and lending, and commerce were prevented from turning into industrial capital in the country by the feudal constitution, in the towns by the guild organisation. These fetters vanished with the dissolution of feudal society, with the expropriation and large-scale eviction of the country population. And secondly, for capitalism to develop, it would require a considerable amassing of wealth if industry was to be able to develop beyond an elementary level. Conventional wisdom explains this amassing of wealth as being due to diligent and thrifty people and their efforts as against lazy spendthrifts. They teach but one side of the coin. The development of society had freed mankind from serfdom and the guilds. Marx and other writers have shown that this amassing of pre-capitalist wealth was by conquest, enslavement, robbery, murder and force. Doubtless many small guildmasters and even small artisans or even wage labourers were able to build themselves into small capitalists. The rags to riches pictured as the norm in film and capitalist propaganda. But this method of development was not nearly adequate for the new market created by the great discoveries, for example, of Christopher Columbus in 1492. The introduction of vast amounts of money into the feudal societies was a product of A. the discovery of gold and silver in America, B. the conquest and looting of the East Indies, 3. the exploitation of Africa, 4. the commercial wars of European nations which raged on a global basis, and E. European Operation China leading to the Opium Wars in the 19th century, more particularly in the 1840s. The colonial system nurtured and ripened like a hothouse both the trade and manufacturing and production for the market generally. This was done through the monopoly of local markets to the destruction of any local competition, which was ruthlessly crushed, as in Ireland, India, and until 1776, by the British in the Americas. This led to the enormous increase of accumulated wealth for the development of capitalist production, formerly dwarfed within the old society feudalism. Such treasures captured outside Europe by undisguised looting floated back to the mother countries. Holland by 1648 was the first to really develop the colonial system and already stood at the height of her commercial greatness. It was in total possession of the East India trade. Its fisheries, trade, marine and manufacturing surpassed those of other countries. And yet by 1648 the Dutch people were overworked, poorer and more brutally oppressed than any other country in Europe. The commercial wars between the nations in the 16th and 17th centuries were the result of the competition between European nations for the colonial spoils. Thus we see that the colonial system, commercial wars, heavy taxation, public debts were so many ways of accumulating capital for the development of the capitalist mode of production. We have seen the motor force for the development and expansion of the merchant, industrialist and capitalist landowner, namely the means by which capital was accumulated. It was the agricultural producer, the peasant, however, that dominated feudal society. And it was this producer that had to be torn from their means of production, the land, in order to be hurled as free and unattached workers onto the labour market. The exploitation of the agricultural producer, the peasant, from the soil was the basis of the whole process. Serfdom in England. In England, serfdom had practically disappeared by the end of the 14th century. The immense majority of the population consisted then, and to a great extent in the 15th century, of free peasant proprietors producing for their own needs. This was even so, though the title under which the peasant held the land was feudal in character and involved an increasingly obscene code of obligations and duties, such as armed service for the lord, work on the roads, harvesting the lord's crops. Such wage labourers as existed were peasants, working part of their time on the large estates, together with an insignificant number of wage labourers. Besides, their wages also included 4 or 5 acres and a cottage. All peasants enjoyed the use of the common land, which gave pasture to their cattle, timber and firewood. The soil was divided amongst the greatest numbers of sub-feudal holders. Such conditions, together with the prosperity of the towns, so characteristic of the 15th century, allowed the existence of wealthy people, but it excluded the possibility of capitalist wealth. The beginning of the revolution that lay the base for the capitalist mode of production took place in the late 1400s and early 1500s. A huge number of free labour was thrown onto the market by the disbanding of the feudal retinues. There had been a long and slow decay of the feudal nobility, commencing in the 13th century. In the heyday of feudalism, there were sometimes 50 to 100 households living directly from the feudal lords. The number of these attendants began to decline during the 16th century. There were many reasons for this. One of the most important was at the instigation of the royal power. Henry VIII, who reigned from 1485 to 1509, came to power after the greatest feudal houses, York and Lancaster, had slaughtered each other in a series of battles during the 1400s, known as the War of the Roses. Henry VII sought financial and political independence from the great feudal lords and sought to establish royal power as unchallengeable. Henry VII and later Tudor monarchs, Henry VIII, Mary and Elizabeth, were able in large measure to do this by a growing alliance with the merchants. The merchants looked to the king to provide security and stability for their own development, which constant warring between rival feudal factions could not. Thus the royal power itself, a product of bourgeois development in its struggle for absolute sovereignty, forcibly hastened the dissolution of the bands of retainers in order to remove any threat to the royal power. Royal power was not the sole cause, for the feudal lords themselves created a much greater and larger proletariat, workers, by forcibly driving the peasant from their lands, to which they had as much right as the feudal lord himself, as well as taking over the common land. The rapid rise of the Flemish wool manufacturers and the greater rise in wool prices in England became the direct impulse and motivation to these evictions. Here was a market for wool. The development of wool manufacturing in East Anglia was a parallel occurrence. Here was a development which was the solution to the major malaise of the feudal lord. Put bluntly, the feudal lord needed money. He had increasingly converted the feudals, the peasants' feudal obligations into fixed money payments. This need for money, if he was to continue to live at the level he'd required, grew more desperate during the 1400s as precious metals poured into England. The 1400s, consequently, were characterised by a continuing inflation and, in consequence, an increasing impoverishment of all those social classes on fixed money incomes. Such a class was the feudal landowner. Transformation of the peasants' land into sheep walks, into production for commodity sale, was therefore the demand of the nobility. Money in a period of rising prices was the power of all powers. Enclosures of the land were not new, they'd been going back since the Black Death of 1380, and the rate of such enclosures did not increase greatly in the early 1500s, and they were not carried out in all parts of the country, not even by the 1700s were they complete. Yet the Tudor enclosures have a decisive importance. The quantitative transfer of land from open field to enclosure and from arable to pasture, proceeding continuously up to this time, assumed a new development with the widespread dispossession of the peasantry. The change coincided with the growth of the population to 5 million, which was about the maximum which the land could support under the feudal mode of production. Under these circumstances, enclosures of an extent which earlier might not have attracted special notice were bound to involve sweeping social changes. As it has been mentioned earlier, these changes coincided with the beginning of a rise in prices, the result of the influx of precious metals into Europe. This had the effect of doubling profits and increasing wages by 50% by the end of the 16th century. The rise in prices became in its turn an inducement to speed up enclosures, since the land became far more valuable. Rents and wages lagged far behind prices, and the new sheep farmers made fortunes. The continuous rise in the price of corn, wool, meat, and all agricultural prices swelled as well. This swelled the money capital of the farmer, while rents particularly, which were paid in 99-year terms, diminished in value. The process of forcible expropriation of the people received a great push in the years 1536 to 39, when Henry VIII, heavily supported by the landowners, dissolved the monasteries. The monks themselves mostly received pensions, but the great majority of monastic servants were less fortunate. The Roman Catholic Church at the time of the Reformation was the feudal proprietor of a great part of the English land. The suppression of the monasteries hurled their inmates into the proletariat. The medieval papacy was a centralised international organisation which established a monopoly in the grace of God. This monopoly was often resented even by kings and princes. At the same time, its degeneration and great wealth made it an easy and attractive prey both for the kings and the landowners. England began competing for control of the papacy with France and Spain. When this failed, they took the first steps towards freeing England from papal control. Three strands make up the Reformation in England, which was initially opposed by the majority of the people. First, the break with Rome, and the end of the large revenues paid to Rome. This was universally approved of, except by the monks. Secondly, the confiscation of the property of the church. This was the work of the crown and the landowning classes. It was less popular, and led even to armed revolts. Thirdly, the victory of the theological dogma known as Protestantism. This was the work of the middle and lower classes. Its progress was slow at first, until Catholicism was finally discredited by its connection with the hostile power of Spain. By way of contrast, Henry continued to see himself as a good Catholic, and impartially executed Protestants for denying the doctrine of transubstantiation, and Catholics for denying that he was head of the church. At Henry's death in 1547, Protestantism was still a minority, but a minority whose desires coincided precisely with the natural course of historical development. The estates of the church were given away in the main to rapacious royal favourites, or sold at a nominal price to speculating farmers who drove out all the hereditary subservants and threw their holdings into one. The share of the poor in the part of the church tithes was tacitly confiscated. This process was extended still further when, under William of Orange, even state lands were given away or sold cheaply. The common lands, which had existed for communal use under feudalism, were progressively seized by the great landowners from 1400 to 1550. These seizures were, by 1700, turned into capital farms. The effect was to release large numbers of former peasants for use as workers in the developing manufacturing industries. The creation of the working class. However, these vast hordes of people could not be absorbed by the manufacturing industries at the rate at which they were thrown onto the market. Well, two remedies to this problem were attempted. One, legislation to check the enclosing of land. This was very ineffective and led to repeated attempts by Acts of Parliament to stop the movement towards enclosure. For example, in 1489, no house was to be destroyed if the adjoining land was more than 20 acres. Other acts limited the number of sheep a farmer could keep. All were ignored, as the JPs who were to enforce the laws were usually the very landlords who benefited by the enclosure. As Marx puts it, quote, "What capitalism required was not a free and prosperous peasantry, the plough in the hands of the owner, but a degraded and servile condition of the mass of the people, the transformation of them into mercenaries, and of their means of labour into capital." Marx's Capital, page 744. Secondly, penal laws were tried against the unemployed. They were effective, but of course they didn't solve the problem. The 16th century saw a variety of legislation punishing vagabonds, beggars and the unemployed, with flogging, branding and hanging. During the reign of Henry VII, 1509-47, 10,000 people were executed for being vagabonds. Merely creating a mass of people forced to sell their labour power is not enough. The bourgeoisie used the power of the state to regulate wages, to force them down to limits suitable for the gaining of a maximum of profit, to ensure a dependence upon capital, and further by lengthening the working day. Wage labourers, which rose in the late 14th century, formed only a small part of the population. The subordination of labour to capital was only formal. That is, the mode of production itself had no specifically capitalist character. During the period we are discussing, labour grew rapidly with every accumulation of capital. Legislation aimed at increasing the working day was started in 1349 and maintained in subsequent legislation. It was against the law to pay wages higher than that laid down by statute. Any coalition of labourers, a union we call it today, was seriously punished from the 14th century up to 1825. By the 16th century, the conditions of the labourers had worsened. Money wages rose, but not sufficiently to counter the inflationary rise in prices. However, the laws keeping wages down remained together, with ear clipping and branding of those who could not find work. In the manufacturing stage of capitalism somewhat later, such measures were not required, as the capitalist mode of production was strong enough to dictate its own terms. At this earlier stage, the legislation was required to compel workers to fulfil their allegedly natural role. Towards the end of the 16th century, change can be noticed. The industries of the town had absorbed a large part of the unemployed. The very growth of these towns had created an increased demand for bread, meat and other foodstuffs. The result was that arable farming became much more attractive and the pressure for enclosures eased off. It's important to notice that this movement was not merely from arable to pasture and then back to arable. Rather, it was from peasant small-scale arable farming to large-scale sheep farming, and then in part to arable farming, but now it was large-scale and capitalist. Though the number of cultivators was less, the produce equaled former years because the agrarian revolution was accompanied by improved methods of cultivation and the concentration of the means of production. Not only was the peasant set free, to form part of the growing proletariat. This process also destroyed the rural domestic industry, which was largely producing for use and not for sale. The country areas were now part of a market for goods produced for sale. The destruction of the domestic industry gave the international market the extension and consistency which the capitalist mode of production required. It is, however, only with modern industry, with its development of machinery, that supplies the lasting basis of capitalist agriculture. Let's have a last look at the towns. In the guilds and trades of the Middle Ages, there was great stability in the means of production. Weaving looms went from father to son. The cost of these looms being relatively small, each journeyman could expect to get back the value of the looms with a few years' work. The Industrial Revolution, by its constant replacement of the existing means of production, requires greater and greater amounts of capital, and this made the entry of the small man into the productive process an increasing rarity. Those existing small businesses fell victim to competition from larger enterprises, who by the 19th century were moving closer to the creation of monopoly. Ownership and control of the productive forces fell into fewer and fewer hands, and more and more erstwhile proprietors found themselves thrown back into the working class. The bourgeoisie, having torn the means of production from the mass of the people, have developed them to a point where each further development creates new and greater problems of overproduction in a world where poverty and shortage are a daily fact of life for the larger part of humanity. Far from developing or evolving naturally, the birth of capitalism was the product of war, greed, plunder and deceit. The rule of the capitalist class now threatens the very existence of the human race. Suggested reading for this: Karl Marx, Capital, Volume 1, Chapters 26 to 32. Dobbs, Studies in the Development of Capitalism, Modern Readers. A.L. Morton, The People's History of England, published by International Publisher. Leon Trotsky, Marxism in Our Time. Marx and Engels, Communist Manifesto and Utopian and Scientific Socialism. And lastly, Ernest Mandel, Marxist Economic Theory.